Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Irving. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. So Terry's just told us where we've come from, and you know, trying to stay humble, I would say that's a pretty good couple of years we've had in terms of reducing debt, reducing overheads. All that's been fairly painful. And as Terry said, now we have $90 million freed up against a run rate EBITDA, or think about that as a cash flow you know, before interest and before depreciation, amortization, and taxes. $90 million against $200 plus or minus is a pretty good amount of money to free up for the operations of the business. So we think we've done a good job. It's been pretty difficult, and there's been a lot of pain involved. But what you guys are really interested in, I suppose, is where are we going from here? You know, where are we today, and you know, what can we think about the future of the company? So one of my favorite value investing firms, Southeastern Asset Management, when they look at an investment, they think about three things. They think about people, the business, and the price. So let me use that template. On the people side, we have about 187 people at our plants, some really good people at the plants. And unfortunately, the finance guys got involved in power and have been involved for 20 or 30 years now. So when you go visit a plant, frequently these people have worked for six different owners in the last 10 or 12 years of their career at the plant. So that's always turning over, and it makes it difficult when you come in and say, okay, here's the way we want you to do something. It's like, okay, there's a new set of people coming in telling us how to do all this. So we're trying to sell at the plants servant leadership. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Cost controls, innovation, not doing things the way they've always been done, but keeping safety first, complying with environmental regulations. And it's a good team. They've really reacted well. We've started rolling out our servant leadership throughout the organization. We work with a fellow, Jim Hunter, who wrote a book on servant leadership, and the response has been great. I would say 99% of the people are thrilled to see that the company's really valuing servant leadership and putting other people ahead of yourself, and you know, how do we all come together as a team. So I can't say enough about the team at the plants. Just you know, they're probably the most important thing we have as a company. And at the next level, we have corporate staff, and the corporate staff's about 42 people. We started out with 110 about 3 years ago. We closed four offices and moved them all into Dedham, and we moved our offices from downtown Boston out to Dedham. That's a lot of people leaving, and unfortunately, not all the work went away. So there was certainly some waste and some people maybe who weren't fully utilized. But to go from 110 to 42, the 42 have a lot more work to do than they had previously. So full kudos to the corporate team, which has had to relocate from outside of Boston or relocate from inside of Boston to Dedham, and then see 60% of their coworkers go away and then pick up all that work and keep running with it. So I think, you know, the morale's terrific. People feel like we did what we had to do. It was necessary. It was painful. And now we're in a better position to move forward. And then the next level of management I'll talk about is the directors. And I'd like to second the chairman's appreciation to Teresa for being on the board for several years. It's she's a great woman, and it's been great to get to know her, and we'll miss her. And then we also have on our board Kevin Howell, who's here today. Kevin's really one of the most well-respected people in the independent power sector, and knows a lot about safety. He's been through this drill before, where power companies have to reduce overhead and reduce costs. And so he's a very valuable asset to the company, and chairs our operating committee, and is always talking about safety at the beginning of the meeting, which is a great mindset to have. And we've done a good job on safety, as Terry pointed out. We had Gil Palter join our board. He's a Toronto native and private equity and finance background person, and it's been great to have him as a partner. We have a lot of robust debates back and forth, and he's always challenging my thinking And so we're glad to have him on board. And I think the shareholders are all served well by having Gil on board. And then we have Foster, who's got a very broad, Foster Duncan's got a very broad industry background, and he's been in utilities and independent power and private equity and run the gamut. So he's got a very broad set of experience for our business. And then we have Holly Ladhani, who's our head of the audit committee, and that's a real thankless task. And she does a great job. She's very detail-oriented, and which is good. I love to see detail-oriented people around me, especially in things like auditing and taxes. And Holly, you know, does a very thorough job. It's a lot of work, and she does a great job, and it's a very thankless task. So we're thrilled to have her as well. As far as the business, so we're in the power business. We're not a utility, in case anybody's not sure about that. I think sometimes maybe the legacy of the company, it sounded more like a utility. But utilities have customers. They have commissions. They have ratepayers. And if there's a problem with cost, they can go get a rate increase and pass it through to the customers. We don't have that. So if there's a problem on costs under one of our purchase power agreements, we have to eat that. And so it's a riskier business than a utility. And people who were here last year remember I wasn't really encouraging it, any retail investor to buy it, thinking about it as a utility or a dividend stock. It's a much more volatile business. We're really in a free market area of power. And it's capital intensive. It's cyclical, it's commodity priced. All that is a very difficult environment. And on top of that, you have lots of state, provincial, and federal regulations on the business. So I think of it more of an investment company that leads to an operating company, which is the power side of the business. And it's a tough sector. And right now, the US stocks, most of the big US IPP companies have been bankrupt once. And 3 months ago or so, they were priced at their lows, their all-time lows. And now they've had a little bit of a pickup recently. So it's a sector. And even looking at it broader than that, energy itself has really had hard times. You've seen energy prices down 50 and 60%, depending on the specific commodity you're talking about. So it's a tough business. A couple of years ago, we looked at it. And the fashion in the market was all about growth. You know, how do we get bigger? And these were already heavily indebted companies, heavily leveraged companies. And they were really focused on mergers and acquisitions. They were focused on, you know, some new venture capital type things like electric car charging stations and all that. And we focused on cost, and we focused on getting the debt down. And we got the debt down about $1 billion, and we got the cost down, as Terry said, about 60%. And it wasn't very sexy, and we got a lot of questions. Well, all these other people are doing this growth stuff. Why are you guys focusing on your own balance sheet? And to me, job one is, you know, we want to protect the downside. You don't want to go bankrupt. Or as Terry always says, rule number one is don't run out of money. And so we're very down to earth, protect the bottom line. You know, we're not going to go out and jump on every latest sexy trend and try to beat the world that way. Having said that, a couple years on, most of the IPPs now are under pressure. Some of them have had activists come in. They're all looking at cutting debt, and they're all looking at cutting overhead. So I think that the crowd, the herd, has kind of caught up with us, which means it's about time for us to about think about growing again. But I'll get to that in a minute. As far as external growth, so what we're doing, I think the most important job for management is probably capital allocation. People, safety, environment, I think, but generally the distinguishing factor tends to be, in terms of shareholder returns, capital allocation. So we just sit there and try to be as rational as possible. And we look at, okay, we could pay off debt. It may only be 5% or 7% or 8% yield debt. But on top of the return you get from paying off the debt, it's like paying off your mortgage on your house. You're building more equity value, and you're also protecting your downside. So in a poor market like we're in now for power prices, you're not in danger of going bankrupt or having to sell off assets in a fire sale. So job one to us is always protect the downside. And Terry's whole presentation was about what we did to protect the downside. And then after the debt, you start looking at more return-driven things to do with your capital. You could do basically five things with your capital. You could buy in equity. You can buy your own debt back. You can invest in your business. And as Terry laid out, we've done some of all that. We're going to do $150 million of debt this year. We've bought in $20 million of shares. We've made over $20 million of investment in our own fleet. Depending on the time we did those things, we had returns of 10 or 12 or 14%. Some of those inside the fleet investments actually had 20% type returns. And if you look out into the market, if you try to do solar deals or wind deals today, you'll get a 6 or an 8% return. So if the decision is we can make 10 or 12 or 14 and invest in our own balance sheet, even though you're shrinking the company maybe, it's a better thing to do with your capital than to try to grow the business doing things at 6 or 8%. I think the great example of capital allocation in North American business history is Henry Singleton. And Warren Buffett calls him the greatest capital allocator in the history of business. And he averaged, I think it was 40% returns on just buying their own shares in. But the concept was, you know, it's so hard for people psychologically to get off of, you know, growth means getting bigger. You know, it's a natural instinct that we want to go buy something. And even as Buffett says, there's never more testosterone and people are dancing around the office than we're doing a big deal. If you go buy in your own shares with your cash, you're shrinking. You'll have less shares outstanding. You're not going out and buying something to add to the asset side of it. So it takes a really contrarian, different, mathematical, really rational focused person to focus on intrinsic value per share. But that's our mantra. We want to try to grow the free cash flow that goes with the shares. And then along with that, for the NBA people in the crowd, the discounted cash flows. And that's what we call intrinsic value. How much cash can we get out of the business? And so when we're buying in shares, if we're buying them in below what they're worth, we're adding value to all the remaining shareholders. It's not as obvious as a dividend, but the dividend is maybe the fifth thing you should do. So you can buy in your own shares. You can buy in your own debt. You can invest in your own fleet. We've done all of that. You can go invest in somebody else's business, generally through mergers and acquisitions. I can buy an asset from you, or I can buy your company. And then the fifth thing is you can pay out a cash dividend, and generally out of excess cash flow. And this business, we have lots of high return uses for our capital, and we still have a lot of debt to pay down. So we decided to focus our cash on those activities. I don't think independent power companies are particularly good vehicles for dividend payers. Large pharmaceutical companies, large utilities, people with very stable business outlooks can put out a dividend and people can rely on it for 10 years. Whereas in this business, the history of people paying dividends and then having to cut them is pretty rampant. So it's not a perfect business because of all that volatility I talked about and the leverage in the system. So what we've said is, look, rather than pay out a 4% fully taxable dividend, we can buy in shares, we can buy in debt, we can invest in our own fleet, we can do 10, you know, as high as 20%, although those investments, the high-end ones, the 20%, were in the own fleet, and we're running out of those things at this point in time. So I think we've got a very stable platform now. We've got the debt in a very manageable place. We've taken a lot of the downside out of the business. We've got a good team put together. The management team, I've been doing power since 86 and in energy since 82, and a couple of the people on the team have similar amounts of experience. We've grown independent power businesses. We've sold 3 independent power businesses. We've sold 25% twice of a business. We've spun off businesses. We've invested in solar plant. We've invested in wind plant. We've made a lot of money investing in wind when the time is right and the returns are right. We've invested in gas and coal and biomass. We've done energy services. So we really have a broad range. And our view of it is really to kind of be patient and don't go out there and just try to shove capital to get bigger if it's a 6% return. Go ahead and wait. And inevitably in this industry over 30 years, there have been times to go in and get very good returns on investment. So right now we think the returns on our shares are very good because we think they're trading well below what we consider to be intrinsic value per share. So we look at that return versus 6 or 8% competing in the market for wind and solar. Now, in the past, we've gotten wind up to 15% returns. And at that point, in the company before this, we put all of our eggs in that basket and went very fast. So I think it's a combination of being disciplined and waiting for the right returns and then being very aggressive and moving with a sense of urgency. So that's what we're trying to do with the business. We're just sitting there every day trying to run the plant safely, trying to get people to think about being more innovative and productive at the plants, following all of our environmental regulations, getting the teams to work as one with no barriers and no defensiveness. And we're looking at our own fleet, and then we're looking at all the things we can do with this money that was so hard to come by. We came up with that $90 million that Terry talked about. We now have about $90 million of cash on the balance sheet versus a market cap of 280. And we've got about $60 million of that cash is discretionary. So over 2 or 3 years, we've gotten ourselves from a position of where we were trying to do too much and we were too stretched. Now we're in a very comfortable place and we can sit back and be patient and disciplined and intelligent about, do we want to pay down more debt? Do we want to buy in more shares? At some point in time, the shares may trade above what we think they're worth, and we may issue shares. At some point in time, external investments may look like a much better return than buying in shares or debt, and then we'll go over to that. So it's no set model. It's all about price to value on every piece of the capital structure, on all our potential uses for the capital, just rational price to value. And I think one of the ways we're trying to make sure, as Terry said, people are aligned, the shareholders and directors, I mean, the directors and the officers have bought a lot of shares. I bought, I think, about $986,000 worth with my own retirement money. I think we've got another director, another officer have bought about the same or more. We've got directors who are putting their whole compensation fee from the company into shares every year. And we've got a number of other officers and directors who've made substantial investments in the company. So we're thinking like owners because we are owners. And so we care about what's the best way to grow the value of this investment. So the last thing is price that I'll talk about, and then I want to move on to the future. But the last present focus thing is price. And what we do is we look at owner's earnings or discounted cash flow. What are all the revenues or cash flow we'll get out of the remaining contracts we have? What's a conservative estimate of what we'll get from those assets after the contracts are gone? What's our overhead? What's our debt that we need to pay down? You know, what's the net of all that? And then you discount it back to the present, kind of a reverse inflation thing, and try to figure out what are your shares worth today. And we've said in the market, insiders have bought up to $3.20 a share, I think, and we thought that we were below our conservative estimates of intrinsic value midpoint when we were doing that. And today we think the shares are still compelling. We bought $20 million. We'd buy a lot more if we were less leveraged. So we have that competing balance of, you know, not trying to do any favors for debt people, and you can't be too conservative. Some people will go to zero debt and pile up cash on the balance sheet and just sit there, and you know that can be selfish and not shareholder oriented if you're trying to make it too safe for yourself. That you know we're never going to have a problem. The other end of the spectrum is you can get a big head about growing the business. You can over leverage. You tend to get these testosterone going, and people make rosy assumptions about what they can buy assets for, And then the debt always turns out to be right in these models. And then oftentimes the revenue is not right. And that's where you get in trouble. So you could be overly conservative and you could be overly risk-oriented. We are certainly conservative, focus on a balance sheet, protect the downside. But we also have a track record of, and we want to, in this business, be able to leap in and be aggressive and buy things and grow things when the opportunity is right. So I'll talk a little bit about that in the context of, we have, let me see if I can do this right. We have a fellow named Alan Bean, who is on the right, your right of the painting. He's an astronaut who was on Apollo 12, and he was the fourth person to walk on the moon. I started thinking about him recently. I got to know him through some of his paintings, and I had fallen out of touch with him, but I got back in touch lately, and I wrote the company a big email about some of the lessons I learned from Alan Bean, which I think relate to what we're trying to do in the company. And a little bit, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landings in a couple of years, 12 people walked on the moon, 6 are left. So it's a little like the World War II generation. We're getting to the end there. And so I think it's a great story about Apollo 12. I think the fact that this astronaut fighter pilot turned into a painter is a great story. So I'm just happy to talk about that. But we try to tie it back to the business. So let me give you my quick Apollo 12 story and Alan Bean story, and then tell you how we're using that in the company. So Apollo 12 was the second flight to the moon after Apollo 11. And Apollo 12, when they were getting ready to launch it, they had a thunderstorm. And they thought about canceling the launch because the protocols are you don't launch if there's any thunder in the area. But President Nixon was in the audience, and the NASA administrators decided, well, we don't want to disappoint the president, and there's a national TV audience. We'll go ahead and launch. So they launched, and if you've seen these things, the giant Saturn rockets, and they're, you know, you're jumping around, and there's all this G-force on you, and as they launch, sure enough, they get hit by lightning, and they all looked at each other, and then they got hit by lightning again, and all of a sudden, the computer board in front of you lit up, and it's like warning lights are going off, and things are blinking, and it's just completely going haywire. And Alan Bean's job and the mission on the launch was to take care of any problems with the computer board. So if you had a malfunction, he had like 2,500 different scenarios he practiced. What do I do? What buttons do I push if this happens? And he said he had never seen that before, where everything was flashing and they didn't know where to start. And so now they're panicking. And you know, remember Apollo 1, we lost 3 astronauts in a fire in a capsule they couldn't get out, White, Grissom, and Chaffee. And that's in the back of our mind. Later on, we lost 2 shuttles. And in Apollo 13, we almost lost. So it's a fairly risky business. Bean says that NASA said it was a 99% chance of going to the moon and back safely, or 99.999 or 3 9s. And he said that Neil Armstrong thought it was a 90% chance they would fly to the moon and a 50% chance they would actually land on the moon and get back safely. So that's their mindset, and they've been hit by lightning, and the boards are all flashing. And Bean said his training as an astronaut is to get back to normal. So when things go haywire, get back to normal. Well, that's a little bit of what we did the last couple of years. We got back to normal where we could kind of take a breath. And then the other thing they did was the classic IT method is they rebooted the computer, and it actually worked. So they rebooted it. Everything's fine. They take a breath, and they're thinking, gee, I hope it's fine. I hope we just didn't, you know, turn it off, but I think it's fine. And then the next moment, they all looked at each other, and a sense of panic set in. And they all thought the same thing at the same moment, which was, we got hit by lightning on the nose of this thing, and the parachute for reentry is in the nose, and it gets deployed with electronic charges, and lightning and electronic charges don't mix. So they're like, what are we going to do about this? And they thought about it and said, you know, one of two things, either the parachute's fine, we go to the moon, we come back, we land, everything's good, or the parachute's fried if we abort right now, we're going to die. If we go to the moon and we come back, it doesn't work, we're going to die. So we might as well go to the moon. And, you know, at least we'll, you know, we'll have schools named after us and what have you. So they decided not to raise this with NASA. Little did they know that on the ground, the NASA people were saying, oh, my God, they got hit by lightning. We don't know if the parachutes are going to work. What should we do? And they decided, well, if they don't work, they're going to die. If we abort, let them go. So they came up with the same analysis. And then the guy in the middle is Dick Gordon, and the guy on the left is Pete Conrad. Pete Conrad was the commander of the lunar module. Alan Bean was the pilot of the lunar module. Dick Gordon is a guy who was up in the capsule. I guess Pete Conrad is one of the great servant leaders in history. Alan Bean told me all the things you like about me in leadership, I learned from Pete Conrad. He's one of the greatest leaders I ever met in the Navy or as a fighter pilot or as an astronaut. He died, I think, about 15 years ago in a motorcycle accident in California. And Bean tells the story about why Conrad is a servant leader, always thinking about the people on his team and not just himself. The pilot of the lunar module, which is Bean, is really just looking at a computer screen and reading out numbers. And Conrad's really the guy steering the lunar module that's going to land on the moon. And so Conrad says to Bean, hey, why don't you fly this thing for a little bit? You're never going to be back here again. And Bean says, that would be great, but NASA will freak out. I can't do that. It's not in the protocols. He says, don't worry about it. Go ahead, fly it a little bit. And Bean says, NASA's going to go nuts. And Conrad says, don't worry, Alan. We're on the dark side of the moon. Only you and I are going to know. And so he turns the control over, and Bean got to fly it a while, and then he turned the controls back over to Conrad, and they landed. This painting, obviously, the big thing wrong with it is there weren't three people on the moon, there were two. And so Alan Bean took his artistic license and painted Dick Gordon, who was actually in the command capsule going around the moon, and he called it his fantasy, that the three of them would be together on the moon at some point. Some company bought it from Bean, and Bean decided it was his favorite painting up to that point in time, and he wanted to get it back, and he tried to buy it back. They lent it to him, and then eventually he bought it back for a premium to what he had sold it to the company so he could get this fantasy back. So they're on the way back in Apollo 12, and they had this is-that-all-there-is moment, and it was, you know, we've been to the moon, and we landed. This is the greatest achievement we're ever going to have. It's one of the greatest technological achievements in history. But, you know, what do we do next? And Alan Bean thought about it and said, you know, I only get one life. The Earth is very fragile. They all had an environmental epiphany when they were on the moon looking back at the little blue orb and how fragile it looked. And Bean said, I'm going to end up painting because that's what I always wanted to do. And they came back from the moon that way. The story I tell at the company for our team is that Alan Bean, when they were trading for this, he came in, they were in the capsule one time, and he told Pete Conrad, the flight engineer is a jerk. I don't really like this guy. I don't think he's up to snuff. You know, we ought to try to get him off the team. And Conrad said, Bean, you don't know the first thing about being a teammate. And Bean got all huffy and defensive and said, what do you mean? Loyalty, hard work, you know, putting other people first. And Conrad told him, none of that matters unless you learn, I pick the team, you don't pick the team. Your job is to find something you respect and admire about everybody on the team and then treat them that way. And so Bean was kind of fulminating over it, thinking about it. He started to leave. And Conrad said, and Bean, that means they're wives too. So 40 years later, I was up in Vermont, and we were getting Alan Bean an honorary doctorate for his paintings. And I should have something in here about Chris Hadfield from Canada, but I don't. And anyhow, 40 years later, I ran into Bean, and he told me that story. And I said, oh, that's a great story. He said, you know that woman we just met here in front of the place, the woman who was a journalist? I said, yeah. He said, my first instinct is it's a journalist. There's nothing good about this. It's going to be, she's trying to get me. And he said, so immediately I have Pete Conrad in my head, and I think three things I respect or admire or like about this person. So he said, every day for 40 years, every time I meet somebody new, I try to think about three things, or every time I'm getting mad at somebody, I try to remind myself about three things I respect and admire. So he said, she had a nice smile. She came here to listen to me speak. She's going to write about my paintings. Get over your bad attitude and treat her well. And Indra Nooyi, the CEO of Nooyi, the CEO of Pepsi-Cola, has a similar thing we've talked about in the company, which she said the most valuable leadership lesson she was ever taught was by her father, who taught her to assume positive intent. And she said most of the time in life when you get really angry at somebody, you think they're taking a shot at you, or you think they meant that sarcastic or negative. He said, sometimes they do, you know, they're just being a jerk. But a lot of times you find out, no, they had a genuine question. It just it came across wrong to you. So always assume the positive first. I just read a book that had chapters on the different astronauts, and the guy who did the book said at the end of the day he felt like Alan Bean was the most positive person he had ever met and the happiest person he had ever met. And so Bean will say, they had an exhibition of his paintings, which actually Bean, these are copyrighted, and we're not actually supposed to have them up here, but Bean gave us permission to put these up for the annual meeting and talk about them. But they had a 40th anniversary of the landing at the Smithsonian, and they put all his artwork up there. And I told Bean, I was at the event, and I said, all these astronauts are like 75 years old, and they're full of testosterone, and they're full of themselves, and they're competitive. And he said, that's, you know, James, they never change. That's the way they were in the 60s, and they're still that way. He said, you know, I just don't get it. He said, everybody's worried about who's got the most money. He said, I got a car with 93,000 miles on it. If you give me more money, I'll get a new car. I'll be happy for a week. I'm a lot happier if I could turn on a great painting and take these stories and leave them for posterity and legacy and let people like you use them as talking points in your company. So I'll get off of this one more painting, and I'll finish up, is the study for the Spirit of Apollo. So this is his kind of magnum opus, not this. This is a study. There's a larger one of these that he did. And he thought this was, he spent 30 years as a painter trying to say, what would best metaphorically represent the spirit of Apollo, which was we came for all mankind. And as everybody knows, or I think most people know the story, so we started the thing as part of a space race with the Russians, and Kennedy said in 61, we'll send a man to the moon and return him safely again. So on the left is Neil Armstrong, the first man to land on the moon, and he's got the American flag that he planted on the moon. And on the right is Buzz Aldrin, the second on the moon, and he has a golden olive branch. He actually left a gold olive branch on the moon, which will apparently be there for millennia because there's no wind or anything. And then behind it is the Earth. And again, they all had this moment of epiphany about the Earth. And so when I talked to the company, I put this up and had a little talk like this. And I said, you know, you always want to be going to work for something greater than yourself. So for your teammates, you want to have some vision and mission. So we spent a lot of time worried about downsides and how do we prevent bad things from happening. So it's a lot like the NASA thing. You're how do we make sure it's all safe and we have margins of safety? But you also have to have a vision, I think, and an animating vision. We think we're helping the environment. We're providing low cost, reliable power that's still safe for the environment. And so that's part of our animating vision. And then I guess in terms of bringing it right back down to the Earth and away from the moon, as we go forward, we think over 30 years we've had opportunities to jump with both feet into wind, or solar, or to buy companies, and we'll have opportunities to do that again. We've looked at batteries. We've looked at storage. We've looked at buying companies. We've looked at partnering with financial companies. So we have every day, every week, we're trying to figure out what's the best way to grow the business and to be ready for when the balance of opportunity shifts from our balance sheet to some of this external stuff that we'll have some pipeline building. One of the things we're focused on are CHP investments, which are smaller industrial size investments. The utility market's fairly broken, and it's hard to get new contracts from the utility side. But if you think about it, energy prices have come down 50 or 60%. wholesale power prices have come down 50 or 60%, but retail or industrial investors, they haven't seen prices come down at all. In fact, they've gone up a bit. And as you put more solar and wind into a conventional grid, you're driving the price down. That's not getting passed through to the industrial guy. The costs are being borne by the existing things on the grid. So what we're trying to pivot our vision from is just trying to service utilities to trying to service more industrial customers, like we did successfully last year at Morris. We had Lyondale Chemical, and they ended up giving us a new power purchase agreement. Most of the power purchase agreements that get done with utilities these days, you go to zero return. There's no money coming. They become merchant. There's very little revenue. Some of them you get done, and the reduction from the old contract's about two-thirds. The Morris one, we more or less broke even. I think we maybe come out a little bit ahead, depending on where some of this little merchant piece comes out. And it was good to work with. I mean, they're faster than a utility. They liked us, and now they're thinking about using us at other facilities or at least bidding on some of their plants. So I think the go forward is we'll take advantage of some volatility. Hopefully we'll get power prices going up at some point, and then we can lock in some hedges. We may be able to grow the CHP. And then as our discipline, we always think about if we can't do a good enough job getting that intrinsic value out for shareholders, then we'll just sell the business. And I've done that three times, so I'm not afraid to do it when that's clearly the superior thing for shareholders. So that's it. I hope it wasn't too much Apollo, but Bean's a wonderful story, and in the company, it's been a good way to talk about some of these messages, and now we'll throw it open to Q&A.